Thank you. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for giving me the chance to speak here, and also the organizer of this program for having me as a postdoc here, so the work here at the Toronto. I would like to talk about the Arnold diffusion and using normally hyperbolic cylinders. This has been a topic for many talks in the past few days. I would like to focus on what we can do for the so-called a priori stable systems. So let me try to use this. So this is our Hamiltonian. I will consider the time periodic case that simplify things a little bit. Actually, I will just put the equation over here so that when I turn the slide, you'll still see them. So H is H0 of P plus HH. And you have n-dimensional torus, n-dimensional action variable, and periodic time. So I'd like to say that I think there are probably some small discrepancy on what people think Arnold diffusion is. But let me just lay something down here. So we say that the system exists, Arnold diffusion, if there exists some constant, such that for arbitrary small epsilon, there exists an orbit of the system and t greater than zero, such that the action variable make a variation greater than this prescribed value c. There are some small issues. For example, one would like to say that you have instability for an interval epsilon all the way up to zero, but that's probably that I do not know how to prove, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not. So basically what I'm saying is that on this interval of epsilon from some small epsilon not to zero, there are infinite many epsilons such that the system exhibits Arnold diffusion. The actual result will actually be slightly stronger than this, but this is the definition I'll be sticking with. So the reason it's called Arnold diffusion is, of course, due to the first example of such a phenomenon, which is a paper by Arnold in 1964. I'll go back to this as the example for Arnold diffusion because philosophically, I think we're sort of still using Arnold's insight. The conjecture by Arnold is that for typical system, and the typical needs to be defined carefully, that the system exhibits Arnold diffusion. So let me say a few words about the resonances. So a vector is resonant if there's an integer relation, and this version here is adapted to time periodic system because the velocity in time duration is always 1. So the real frequency vector is omega comma 1 in a sense. And the frequency that's given by the partial derivative of the integrable part will be deciding approximately the frequency of the perturbed system. And this is the case for n equal to 2, then you have all these rational lines that covers the space, there's too many to draw. So the belief is that Arnold diffusion should happen along these lines. So the diffusion occurs going along one line and maybe you switch to another line, etc. So in this talk, we'll be focusing on just a single resonance. So here's actually I will say something about the double resonance in the end, but now it's a single resonance. So basically, in the frequency space omega 1, omega 2, just this vertical line, omega 1 equal to 0. So this is a model example. Consider this 2.5 degree of freedom system, And assume that perturbation splits into two parts. One part depends only on the theta 1. And the other part, when you integrate with respect to theta 2 and t, and the integral is equal to 0. Then what happens is that you can make a symplectic change of coordinate. I have to say some restriction here. So how and in what sense you can make this change of coordinate, and in what sense is the higher order term small, I will be specifying later. But the rough idea is that you can change coordinates, basically this is a version of averaging, such that you eliminate H2 and replace it with something that's smaller. And this inspires this definition of a priori unstable system. Basically, we do not treat epsilon as a small parameter anymore. Rather, we start treating the higher order term as a perturbation. So epsilon will be considered fixed. And to avoid some technicality, we can also choose epsilon equal to 1. So basically, we will have the following system. With this system, you can think of it as the one written above, which is a product of a rotator and a pendulum. So it has some special structure. In particular, it has a stable, unstable separatism. And this is a source of instability, and this is called a priori unstable. So many have been a hot topic, and we heard many talks already about a priori unstable system. So, in general, there are geometrical methods and the variational methods working on a priori unstable system. So I think it started with Chiocchia and Garavotti, and then there are many papers. I'm not sure I'm quoting them with the right time that they appeared, because sometimes papers appear after they're available. So but basically, you have Chiocchia, the Sham, the Yab, and Sierra, and also we heard about the improvement by the Sham and Huguet, which improved the genericity condition for the result. The two groups were working on variational methods. Patrick Bernard, who's one of the co-authors of this work, worked on a point of view using symplectic maps, iterating symplectic graphs, and Chen and Yang in two papers and worked on a variational setting for this Arnold diffusion for a priori unstable system. I would like to also mention Mather's work on a priori stable system. So Mather announced a much stronger result than what we're trying to present here in 2003, and parts of his manuscript are available. So it goes without saying that his work has been very influential on our thinking and the methods that we use. So I want to just explain a little bit. Maybe I'll leave that to the later. So this is we're able to prove is that assume that you have some sufficiently smooth Hamiltonian, and quotation mark typical epsilon H1. Here I normalize the perturbation itself to have norm 1 and with epsilon as a small parameter. There exists some a small number which depends only on the projection of the perturbation on the unit sphere and the orbit such that the diffusion distance is larger than this value. So in a sense, this sort of fits my definition of Arnold diffusion earlier, that for epsilon go to 0, you always have Arnold diffusion, and the distance of diffusion is independent of epsilon. But I would like to mention the difference between our result and what John Mather has announced is that I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Basically, you can prescribe a certain path in a diffusion space. Then there is a sort of a generic set. Then you pick any perturbation in that set. Then you will follow this path that's prescribed. So here we cannot prescribe the path. The path depends on the perturbation that we choose. We're only saying that as epsilon go to 0, it has diffusion. But it may be very short if H1 is very a horrible function. So that's the content of the first remark here. Here I want to remark on what the typical means. So here we draw a picture. So imagine this is the unit sphere of CR, although it's square. But so basically this is the sphere, and this direction is epsilon, and this is H1. And what the generic condition that Mather introduced is that there are certain lines that are degenerate, which we want to avoid. So these phases we cannot diffuse. In addition, the closer we are to the degeneracies, the smaller we need to choose our epsilon. So basically, what happens? We need to exclude a cusp-like set from each of these degeneracies. So there goes the cusp part of the condition. Then there is an open and dense set in the rest of the set, such that you will have Arnold diffusion. And going back to my earlier comment about this interval of epsilon, that means if you take a typical section, you're not likely to have all epsilon exhibiting diffusion, but almost everyone will. So that's the statement of the generalistic condition. So I would like to go back to the Arnold's example to illustrate our method. So we have heard a few times that this system considered by Arnold, if you ignore the second perturbation, is simply a pendulum times a rotator. In particular, you have all these homoclinic orbits going back from each torus on this on the cylinder back to itself. What happens when you turn on the perturbation? So I need to be careful when drawing this picture. I should have drawn it before. So somehow I need to make things transversal. When you are perturbed, and you're likely to have two transversally intersecting stable and unstable manifold, and the intersection is exactly a homoclinic orbit for this. So with this picture here, I will just show the rest of the slides. So what we have, so first of all, in a sense, it's an a priori unstable system because we're treating mu as a small parameter. There's a three-dimensional normally hyperbolic cylinder. I'm drawing two-dimensional if you consider time one map. This cylinder itself is foliated by many tori, and for time one map, many invariant circles. Stable unstable manifolds intersect transversally. I want to stress the fact, this is the equivalent statement, that if you look at this intersection, which is the homoclinic orbit, which is decided by the heteroclinic homoclinic intersection of stable unstable manifold, it's localized. Because whenever you have accumulation, then you cannot have transversal intersection. So I draw a picture, it's not good enough, so we did there. So this is the picture. You have these cylinders, and this is for the perturbed system. There's an isolated homoclinic orbit. So the reason I'm going to this point of view is that this fits the variational setting started by John Mather. So what we are going to do is the following. We start by looking at the following Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is slightly different from the Legendre transform, the Hamiltonian, but not by much. Because the Euler-Lagrange equation that defines will be the same. So the orbit of this Lagrangian will be the orbit of the original Lagrangian. And And this Lagrangian has this special property that it favors orbits that's rotating in the direction of C, if you consider minimizing orbit, because of the theta dot minus C squared. And it's easy to see that for the Arnold example, each of these circles minimize on an infinite orbit the integral of this Lagrangian, because the Lagrangian is always a greater or equal than zero, and the integral on these orbits are equal to zero. So you cannot get any smaller. So these circles will now be renamed the Meunier set. And I think I had a mistake with the definition of Meunier set. I have to allow minimization on any A and B that differ by integer value. So it is in this case, things are okay because of the simple example. So this invariant toroid on the cylinder are Meunier sets. For each of these sets, you have a homoclinic orbit to this cylinder, and they are minimizing orbit if you do not allow the orbit to stay on the cylinder. You force it to make one loop around the theta 1 direction. And this corresponds, if you look at a double cover of the system, then you'll be looking at minimal orbits of this type. So for lack of better name, I call it the lifted Meunier set. So the lifted Meunier set, which is our homoclinic orbit, is isolated. Then the statement is, if this set is isolated, then for a nearby C, there is an orbit connecting the Meunier set corresponding to C, and the orbit corresponding to the Meunier set for the nearby C. And the proof of this statement is Mader's method of changing Lagrangian. And the basic idea is, if you, instead of looking at the integral from minus infinity to infinity, you look at the integral of minus infinity to zero of LC plus zero to infinity of LC prime. Of course, you want some smoothing terms so that the Lagrangian remains good. And the statement is that if the Meunier set is isolated, then it's possible to have a minimizing orbit for this, and in backward time it will be asymptotic to this level C, and in the forward time it will be asymptotic to this level C prime. And alternative proof of this was also given by Chen and Yan on this somewhat saying that these sets, when you perturb them, has a upper semi-continuity. Then it's quite easy to see that if you have this isolated set, then it's possible to have a minimizing orbit connecting C and C prime. So basically, this question of whether you can go from one cylinder to another, one invariant torus to another torus via the normally hyperbolic cylinder, reduces to the question of studying whether these Meunier sets are isolated or not. So now I come to a more general situation of a priori unstable system, which differs by Arnold's example, that now the perturbation will change the cylinder. The cylinder still survives because it's the hyperbolicity, but it will be distorted. More importantly, the dynamics on the cylinder will no longer be integrable. So what happens is that we can still look at the Meunier sets, but they end up being one of the three kinds. It could be an invariant torus, toroid, periodic orbits, or these cantoroid, which is sort of given by the dashed dot line in the middle. So it's relatively easy to look at the homoclinic orbit to an invariant torus, just like in the Arnold situation. But it's much less obvious what to do when you have a Cantor ray. So the theorem that proved using different methods by Bernard or and Chen and Yan imposes the following condition. The first one is not that essential, but it needs to be used for now. But the second one is essential, that whenever you have an invariant torus, then the magnetic set to itself is isolated. So the idea is that according to let me go back to the previous picture. If you have all these invariant torus separating things, you have to go along the homoclinic orbit. The work of Mather on 1989 showed that if you don't have all these invariant torus, you can stay inside the cylinder, and there is orbit that travels from the lowest invariant torus to the highest invariant torus. So this, in the geometrical method, will be called the inner map and outer map. And in the variational setting, it's somewhat similar, and we take advantage of the situation of the characterization of the dynamics on the cylinder. So basically, all we have to worry about are the invariant tori. But the second requirement on the invariant torus is a non-trivial one for the following reason. The point is, there are too many invariant tori on the cylinder. At least there were the KM ones. So that already give you uncountable mailing. And then there may be other ones. So what one needs to prove is that these variational defined orbits are isolated simultaneously under generic perturbation. So you have an uncountable family, and you have all these homoclinic orbits. You want to say at the same time, they are all totally disconnected. And this F-sum work can be reduced to talking about a one parameter family of functions having isolated minima. However, the how the function depends on this parameter is unknown. So in the worst case, you could have a space-filling curve, and any perturbation will always intersect itself. So this insight by Chen and Yan is that although you have no good dependence on the parameter, nevertheless, this family, when viewed in a functional space, occupies a finite box counting dimension. So in particular, its complement is almost everything. So then for this residual set of perturbation, this condition can be satisfied. So let me go to this a priori stable situation. So we consider n equal to 2 for simplicity. For higher n's, we'll not be looking at single resonance, we're looking at n minus 1 resonances. The key is that we want three-dimensional invariant cylinders. So in arbitrary dimension, we'll average with respect to n minus 1 resonance. And the picture will be similar to the one resonance case. So you have the red one, which is omega 1 equal to 1. Then you have the blue one, which are other resonances. And there's a normal form theorem, which says that you have all these intersections of the blue one and red one, which are double resonances. And if you look at the neighborhood of this red line, but exclude a small ball close to the intersections, then on this set, you have a normal form. But the normal form is tricky in the following sense. How small the remainder would be depends on which resonances you exclude. So we want the delta small r, but it cannot be arbitrarily small, because this delta dictates what resonances to remove, and it restricts how far the diffusion can go. we want diffusion distance does not go into zero as epsilon go to zero, delta must be fixed relative to epsilon. It cannot go to zero, it can be arbitrarily small, but it's not any order of epsilon. So this is a slightly tricky situation, but we can prove a normally hyperbolic cylinder in this case. So this not very well drawn picture at the bottom is an artifact of the rescaling we have to do to prove this to prove the existence of the cylinder. In particular, if you look at the C1 estimate of the cylinder, you will have square root of epsilon on the denominator. So basically, the theta derivative with P2 is the vertical direction. The theta derivative, the P2 derivative of theta of the angular variable is huge. So it has this huge oscillations. I mean, the picture itself is just for fun, but the quantitative estimate is important. I'll remark on that. So we have the following statements. So basically, we're talking about everything that I said in the a priori unstable case has a counterpart in this situation and can be treated in a similar way. So first of all, if you look at the Meunier sets, those are the minimum orbits that minimize this Lagrangian, then they are contained in the cylinder. And the second statement is that these sets are not only contained in the cylinder, they are actually graphs on the cylinder, contained in the graphs on the cylinder. So this phenomenon is so Mada has proved the graph theorem for, in general, the Meunier set. And in this restricted sense, he also called this projected graph theorem, which means that you can further reduce the dimension of the Meunier set. So just a remark on the last result. The C1 estimate for the cylinder is essential for proving that you have this property. So basically, the rough idea of the proof is the following. You're perturbing an integrable system, so all these invariant sets stay more or less at a constant p-value. So it's actually staying on a very flat graph. Then it becomes a competition with this horizontal oscillation of your cylinder and the flatness of this plane, you know that it has to stay on. So if you have a good estimate, then you can prove that the intersection is actually a graph. And as a consequence, which limits everything to lower dimension, then the same conclusion holds. Each Meunier set can only be either torus, a periodic orbit, or cantorus. Then we assume basically the same assumptions. So assume that the Meunier set has an invariant torus. That is, an invariant torus has an irrational rotation number. The second point is that the Meunier set is, if it's an invariant torus, then it's isolated. And the genericity theorem of Chen and Yan applies that you can have this non-degenerate situation for the whole family. It's a pity that I completely ignored the subscript of lambda. It's an additional a situation coming from the question. So allow me to briefly remark on that, because I didn't mention at all. So I'll slowly go back. So here the statement is there are finitely many normally hyperbolic invariant cylinders. This is due to the property of this averaged function z as you vary the second parameter p2. So what happens is that typically a function only has one minimum. But if you vary it in a family, it could be bifurcations. You could have one minimum jumping to another minimum. So possibly there are finite many strips on which you have unique minimum. And at the intersection point, you have two minimums for this function. And what happens is that that gives us multiple cylinders. So the discussion applies to a single cylinder. But we have to do some rather technical work to show that it's possible to jump from one to the other. So so the geometrically is actually quite clear. Here is probably a disadvantage of a variational method, because since we're looking at the minimum action, then when you have two cylinders, you don't really know which one is smaller than which. Then basically what we need to do is to say generically one is smaller than other, and you don't have this jumping back and forth too often. So, but with that technical issue resolved, it's possible to jump from one cylinder to another. So I have a little time, so I would like to say something that's that sort of fits the theme of the talk, but we're not yet claiming any results. So basically, we want to look at what happens in this troublesome part, which is double resonance. So we look at the following system, and we pick a simple double resonance, which is when P1 and P2 are both equal to zero. So we have we can do averaging, and basically notice that with the averaging, the only thing that I've eliminated is the time dependence. So this is the best you can do in double resonance situation. Then with the rescaling, I've replaced P with zero, because P is of order square root of epsilon, that gives you a higher order term. So basically, by some rescaling, you end up having this 1/2 I squared plus z theta 0 plus perturbation. So this is related to a 2-degree freedom mechanical system. So we're not having any perturbative result. We just, for now, ignore the remainder. And maybe we can say something about this 2-degree freedom mechanical system. So I'll probably give out spoilers to Professor Mather's talk tomorrow. So I'll try my best not to spoil too much. So what happens is that you have the Marbodie principle, but you have a minimum energy where you can go. When you reach this energy, the Jacobi metric, which defines the remaining metric, becomes degenerate. But as long as you're outside, you have minimal geodesics. So Professor Mather already put out a manuscript on the situation, on the minimal geodesic of this. So I will just sure that if you look at minimal geodesics, they may not be simple. You have a degenerate point, and they could intersect at the point. And what happens is that you have multiple simple curves, and the minimal geodesics trace them one by one. So assume you have two, then you have the following situation. So generically, you have hyperbolic saddle point at this point with distinct real eigenvalues. And each of these are a homoclinic orbit to this hyperbolic saddle point. And the part that is about the distinctness of eigenvalues is important due to the following picture. If you look at the stable manifold, you have one direction that's attracting much stronger than the other one. Then all orbits of this will actually look like this. So except if you're staying exactly on the strong manifold, you're anywhere else, the strong direction will contract much faster than the weak direction. You end up always tangent to the weak direction. So assume that you have two. This is actually more general. So what we're looking to say is that there is cylinder, and we think that it will survive when you add the third degree of freedom. But again, this is work in progress. So what is the base of this belief is that if you have a homoclinic orbit of this non-degenerate saddle, then typically you have orbits tracing them. So you can have any different combination of one orbit and another orbit. Actually, you have symbolic dynamics. There is an additional assumption which I'll specify over here. The additional assumption is the following. If you look at the stable manifold, so this is a two-dimensional stable manifold. There is a one-dimensional strong stable here, and it separates the stable manifold into two parts. And the requirement is that if you start from an orbit that is in one part, then it has to come back on the same part in order to connect. So there is this requirement that if this requirement is satisfied, then you can arbitrarily concatenate the orbit. Here I'm just saying the case when you can concatenate two orbits, and there is actually orbit shadowing them. Now, as you vary the energy, then this sweep out an invariant cylinder that converge to this figure A given before. So with some work, we can actually see that you have this family of periodic orbit. Each one of them is hyperbolic on the transversal direction. And as the energy goes to zero, this whole thing converges to figure eight. So this is the picture of the cylinder that exists in the two-degree freedom system. And we have reasons to believe that this picture should survive if you add the third direction with a very weak interaction between the third degree of freedom and the first 2 degrees of freedom. So I think I went a little fast, but this will be the end of my talk. Thank you.